Hi, I'm Tony Morales, and welcome to another edition of All Access with Film Music Media. Here with my buddy Kaya, and we are going to talk all things film music and TV music and possibly a little bit of scotch. Talk. And drink.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for inviting me here to your studio. It's so great to talk again.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to see you and to catch up.
Absolutely. So let's start. You know, we've done interviews in the past, but, you know, let's start fresh for people who may not know you or just coming to you for the first time. And I want to know a little bit about your background, your intro. Like, going back to your childhood, when do you remember, I guess, music making its first impact on you, where you're like, okay, this is something that's resonating with me?
Well, I, as far back as kindergarten and first grade, you know, child of the late 70s, was very much into rock music, in particular, Kiss was a big draw. And I was part of that young kid generation where the, you know, Kiss probably got to a point like, wow, we have kids coming to our concert. That was me and my parents. So at that point, I had, you know, all their albums and just couldn't listen to them enough after school. And my parents, I remember them buying me a drum kit after begging them. And once I tore through that, I would just play on the albums. And then eventually it led to a guitar. It'd be a quieter thing to buy. But once I got the guitar, it was literally just big and heavy. And I did, like, that's as far as it got at that point. So fast forward a couple years, when I was 9, and I got a little bit more courage to try it again. I got a little bigger, I grew. And then a real turning point was we had a neighbor up the street who played guitar, and he happened to play all the music that I wanted to learn. So he kind of kickstarted things for me, because I could actually tangibly start to test music and I guess express myself. And so had some lessons with him, learned how to play a bevy of Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne.
Which we're just talking about. Right?
Exactly. And then I was kind of on my way. And that led to essentially learning everything he knew at the time, which was all just by ear and just, you know, tablature. This wasn't, you know, any traditional study at that point. And I went on to essentially teach myself with books and, you know, was heavily, you know, into rock music. And, you know, this time we're in the 80s and all that stuff. And it just kind of continued. So by the time I got to high school, it had gone on, and I was ready to learn more. I went as far as I could go as far as showing myself and guitar tablature, and I needed to learn how to, you know, I needed more. So my parents signed me up for traditional lessons, and at the same time I was fortunate enough to go to a high school that actually offered a music program and had music theory and had jazz band. And so I was just like a sponge, and I just, you know, took classes in jazz band, and I was taking classical guitar, and I was learning electric guitar and learning how to read music, and it all just kind of kept going.
So then at what point did you find film music, and when did that start? When did you decide to make it a career? Like, when did, at point you were like, okay, this is what I'm going to do for a living?
Great question. Well, so all that kind of upbringing and studying my instrument led me to look at music as a career. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I had in my sights was to be possibly a studio musician, because the whole point of all that, everything in my adolescence learning was just to be, you know, the best guitar player I could be. So it just seemed like it was something I wanted to give it a try. My parents were supportive enough to say, okay, you know, we'll send you to music school, and, you know, if I can get in. And so I applied to Berklee College of Music and got accepted and attended there. And freshman year, I had a buddy who had taken an appreciation of film music class. Mm. And at Berklee, all the students that are incoming have to go through a certain levels of musical proficiency and education aside from your focus.
Right.
So
right.
I was there to shed and play, you know, 8-finger solos, but I had to take classes in arranging and counterpoint and ear training and all that stuff. So already my scope was widening. Mm. So when I heard about this film music class, I just thought it sounded fascinating, and I took it. And one of the things that really made a major impression on me at the time was Jerry Goldsmith's score to The Omen.
Oh, yeah.
Because I equated it very much to like a heavy metal score.
Yeah, of course.
And coming from where I came from, it was fascinating. And I couldn't believe that somebody wrote that, and that if so, that was my discovery of it. Mm. And from there, it led to learning more about, you know, Bernard Herrmann, and at the time, you know, Danny Elfman was you know, humongous in the world, Thomas Newman. And so I just turned my focus at that point, and all with all the composition classes I had to take, I also switched to film music as my major, and just dove in deep.
So what was the kind of the first step into getting that first job? You mentioned you were aiming at being a studio musician, and you did work with Harry on some scores, and of course you worked with Brian Tyler on a bunch of stuff. But what were kind of the first steps, and did you learn from becoming an assistant and just kind of absorbing everything? And what were the first like things you were able to get your fingers on?
My path took a while to kind of figure out for me how to make an entrance. When I got out of school, so I graduated from Berkeley, and then I also heard about a fantastic program at USC, which was the film and TV music program there at the time, which was an advanced studies program, not a graduate program like it is now. So I moved out to California, I applied to the program, I got accepted, I moved to California and took the program. And then when I got out, I felt like I was one of the only graduates who did not get that assistant job, or I did not have a lead.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, in hindsight, I just didn't know what to do. It wasn't as tangible as it is these days, where there's networks of ways to kind of figure out who needs something and all that. So I actually took a job for 3 years out of music, and just a job at a graphic design company, and paying bills, and at night continuing to score student films. And, you know, my buddies would call and be like, oh, so-and-so has a, you know, need for an assistant. I applied to be an assistant for Mark Shaman and actually David Schwartz, because I had another friend who worked for him. But I just didn't have the technical skills because, you know, again, this was like, you know, when I graduated in 96. And we, you know, Pro Tools wasn't so huge and all the computer things. So those who knew that stuff had a humongous leg up on everything. Fast forward to 3 years later, I had a chance encounter with Harry Gregson-Williams through an ad. A friend of mine and I lived in an apartment in Venice we just moved into, and we overextended, and we couldn't afford it. So we put up an ad for Roommate Wanted at the local pizza place, Abbott's Habit. I'm not sure if it's still there on Abbott Kinney. And in walks this woman, Melissa, and she came with two of her friends, one of them Harry and another and Harry's wife, and it was a random chance encounter. Well, we asked her to move in, and we befriended, we all became buddies, and about 6 months later, I kind of realized who Harry was, because he was kind of new in town, maybe about a year or two.
Yeah.
And I got the courage to give my cassette, said, hey, you know, I'm a composer too, and you know, da da da. So that actually led to him passing it on to someone over at Media Ventures who were in the commercial department, and they were looking for young writers to do some freelance work, and they gave me a shot doing a blockbuster video commercial.
Oh my God, that's amazing!
And I demoed and I got the commercial, and then I spent the next year because they just it was serendipitous. I actually left my day job.
Yeah.
Right around the time I gave him the CD, or I got the call, and I just kind of was ready to temp and just make it happen.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that because that worked out, I got hired to go there for about a little under a year and work on staff as a commercial composer. And that was basically the beginning.
Wow. That's a great story.
Yeah. So it's super random, and but pretty incredible when I look back on it, how it just kind of happened.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we focus on some of your projects, I'm kind of interested in kind of your approach in general into just whether when you work on something, where does the first note come from for you? I know it's going to be different depending on what kind of project you're working on, but typically do you have a process that you do? Do you like to watch a first cut of the film? Do you like to talk to the director or the producer? Do you like to read the script? I mean, what's kind of the general thing that you can kind of get ideas start pulling out of your head?
Yes, like you said, it's going to be different depending on what I'm involved with. But the one thing that's universal on no matter what I end up working on is the first thing I want to do is get as much information as I can. And whether that's conversations with the filmmakers or the in television, the producers, showrunners, seeing the cut, do they have temp music? Do they not have temp music? Just absorbing everything, trying to, within the schedule of things, make the most of the little bit of time you have before the clock starts ticking and you have to write music or and start producing things, mm-hmm. and just try to marinate in it as much as I can throughout all that. And then usually what I get to and what I look forward to getting to is essentially just starting to test ideas.
Yeah.
And that is that comes with a lot of, you know, improvisation or sound palettes, or maybe if I just don't have any clue and they don't have any direction for me as far as, you know, what they like, then I will sit down and sometimes just listen to music. Mm. Put it to picture, see if it sticks, see if it, how it feels. Maybe it tells me that what I don't want to do or what doesn't work. You know, eventually hope that I get there. I mean, I usually get there to some degree.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes it's longer and harder than others.
You know, you've done so many varied projects in different genres. And I feel like genres are each kind of come with a territory of types of music that come with it. Do you find different genres more challenging than others? Or do you kind of just see, doesn't matter what the topic or the tone of anything is?
Yeah, you know, everything is tough to be vague. Sorry. it's all.
Usually I hear comedy and horror are kind of the more harder ones, but.
Comedy's hard because, you know, rarely do you get to ask write music that's funny.
Yeah.
You know, doing comedy and particularly, and again, trends in music change.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will say, because I've been so immersed in it in the last few years, I will say animation is probably the hardest thing I've ever had to work on to date.
Right.
Just because it's really, I don't know if this will sound pompous or the wrong way, but it's like really honest composing.
For
so,
sure, yeah.
Meaning there's no hiding, but there's no taking notes off. Mm. Everything has to be purposeful, and you have to be able to do all the shifting and you know, playing the animation. But in particular, on a show like I do with Elena, there's a lot of comedy within the storyline, and what they want is a cinematic sound, and hitting all that stuff and trying to do it as elegantly as you can is really, really hard.
Well, let's talk about Elena, because I mean, congrats, you got an Emmy nomination.
Thank you.
For your work on the show. And talking about genres, working on children's animation, mm-hmm. which, you know, I work at Cartoon Network, so I'm in mm-hmm. that world as well. And over at Disney, I used to work at Disney. But I mean, talk about, does that change the approach at all? I mean, what when you first started the show, you're on season three?
End of season two, season three in a couple months, yeah.
So when you first started the show, what were the kind of how did you find the sound for Elena? I mean, what was the process to get there? And then how did the show evolve, I guess, across those two seasons so far?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, they're a fantastic team to work with. They've always been really supportive and really, like, you know, nurturing and helping me whenever I got to a place that was like, you know, okay, how do we want to do this? The initial discussions when talking about the sound of the show was to figure out how to infuse Latin overtones mm-hmm. with the Disney enchantment sound, mm-hmm. because you know, Elena is inspired by all Latin culture all over the world, not just one country. And so how do you umbrella something like that?
Yeah.
It was very difficult, and I went and arranged from early score tests from, you know, very, very legitimate, you know, maybe something that felt like Mexican folk music, to less orchestra, to really full orchestra that has more of that Disney sound, but we can infuse some guitars or some Latin percussion in there and just kind of try to find the balance. And it took a good, I would say at least halfway through season one for me to really, really get comfortable and feel like I started to figure out the balance between the two, and that I didn't necessarily need to lean on one or the other for the show. Just kind of tell the story, try to, you know, keep it as cinematic as you can possibly do with what we have to work with, and support those indigenous or ethnic storylines as they come, and then, you know, pepper it throughout the series.
And is it an 11 minute or 22 minute episode?
It's a 22 minute episode. Yeah, so, and one 22 minutes, so one story.
Right. So in a typical 22 minute episode, how much music is being used or utilized?
A lot.
Because I feel like it's different than most other animated shows.
It's heavy. Yeah. It's just been, and we tried to do this at the beginning. We tried to come out of the gate, not wall-to-wall scoring, mm-hmm. but I failed. it just didn't.
Which is not a bad thing.
It's fine. It's just.
Usually those shows are just like little stingers and transition points. But if you get to like flesh out,
I learned a lot on the show. I really, really did a lot of studying of all of my heroes in animation music. You know, John Powell and Randy Newman and John Debney, and watched a lot of what how they would very gracefully score and continue to score and not feel exhausting and or redundant in what you're doing musically. The thing with Elena is there's a song in every episode. Now, I don't write the songs. They have a dedicated songwriter, amazing composer, this guy John Cavanaugh, and he will co-write the songs with whatever writer co-writes the lyrics. Mm-hmm. They do those. They pre-produce those. So those are done before the animation happens.
Okay.
So that relieves at least 2.5 minutes for me per episode. And then when I have two songs in an episode, I'm just like,
yes.
Dancing. it just works that way. Now it's to a place where when you come out, you feel it. If it's too long, you feel it. And the show just is a fast-paced show. It's television. It's, you know, it's 20 minutes. They have two commercial breaks. So part of the art of that is to keep the momentum going.
Yeah.
And it's rich with storylines. And there's usually like a couple of lines going in one episode. And they've got serial storylines and characters that come back and recur and keep going. So, it's a lot to support. But it's been a blast to work on. It's been tremendously educational.
And I always hear that TV schedules are just crazy hell and just super. Is it comparable to like a network show that you do? Like,
yeah, it is, because it's you have more days than technically you do mm-hmm. on network. Like, for example, when I was in Scorpion with Brian, we would have anywhere from 5 to like from spot to deliver.
Yeah.
We would have 5 at the worst times, but usually around 7 to 9 days.
Wow.
And from spot to delivering the score to the stage and handling revisions at the end of that and then starting the next one. With Elena, we have 2 weeks from spot to preview. But the difference is, and it's actually half the amount of time as the other, the difference is style. You know, with the Scorpion had a more contemporary and was definitely not orchestral. And there's just... the programming the orchestra all in the computer is super time consuming, and particularly when you're trying to do a Disney really full winds, brass, percussion, you know, very wide, it's even more time consuming. So it's a full 2 weeks. So yes, it's comparable, even though it's shorter, but it's still a lot more.
We were just talking about Elena of Avalon, so let's switch gears to live action, which you have a film coming up, An Actor Prepares, which you get to reunite with director Steve Clark, which you worked with mm-hmm. previously before.
Yeah.
So talk about this film and what challenges it bring. And when you first started talking with Steve, what were the first conversations that you had about what the music needed to be for this?
So the second film was Steve Clark. Awesome guy, awesome director. He's based out of New York. And when he first reached out, I was thrilled to hear from him, and we talked a bit about the film, and I was able to watch a cut. And as we kind of talked about earlier, it was going to be a comedy score, and mm-hmm. We had a lot of discussion about that. But the film actually is more of a coming of age story.
Yeah, describe what the film is.
It's a coming of age story about mm-hmm. a father and son who had an estranged relationship, who come together over circumstances and have to spend a lot of time together, and then end up understanding one another better.
Starring Jeremy Irons, right?
So the father is Jeremy Irons and the son is Jack Houston. And it's a lot of fun. The movie is, there's a lot of humor in it, and you know, but at the end of the day, it does have some emotion to it, or it does have some heart to it. That's probably the better word. And so when Steve and I were talking, that was the real challenge. How to give the score some heart, but also not overdo it with anything that felt sappy or maudlin.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation early on with a producer on the film, David Rosenthal, who was helped, you know, in kind of relaying, like, make, you know, we want to try to give the score, you know, have it sound special and just be a part of the fabric and not overtake it and not, you know, steer you.
Yeah.
So that came my way, and in the rough cut that I saw, there was a lot of songs, and there was a lot of songs that they were gonna keep that I heard, mm-hmm. which I thought was real beneficial because I could get the tone of what was gonna be in the score that was gonna be song related, and they had a few temp tracks in there, but not a lot. So I also was happy to hear that and not get too sucked into something that may or may not have been the right approach. So based on that and some other conversations about instrumentation, we kind of made a collective thing to avoid piano as much as possible, just to try to, again, about just being careful not to be too emotional. So talking about my upbringing with the band, I thought this was a great opportunity because I to kind of go back into a band kind of world with the score and play, you know, make it be a band, you know, guitars, bass and drum, some textures with the guitars, and I think we used a melodica, some Rhodes, just, you know, like a band setting, and score the film like that. So I came up with a leitmotif for Jeremy Irons' character, Atticus, and then an overall umbrella theme that kind of put in this indie pop genre. And it seemed to work, and it seemed to stick and not make it too emotional, but it really works well with the songs when they come in, and then when the score comes in, it's kind of all one.
That sounds like a challenge to me to navigate, like, songs, to weave everything to make it seem cohesive. Is that a trial and error process where it's like, okay, this tone needs to match if it's going to dovetail into, like, something else? Did that ever happen where you score dovetails into a song, or do you have kind of some space between?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it certainly has happened before in other projects. And this one, I think we didn't actually physically go into each other, but, you know, one scene would have a score track and the next one would have, you know, maybe a song interlude or, you know, because there's a lot of time, you know, as they're doing the road trip where there's montage and other stuff, and song was mostly supporting those.
Right.
But then there's a couple of times where, you know, score came in because it just made more sense to do. And we didn't want it to seem like, okay, here comes the orchestra and then here comes the band and then, you know. I did what I thought worked, and collectively we figured it out, and it seemed to have a nice cohesion to it.
How is it different this time working with Steve that you've worked with him before? Mm-hmm. People are always interested in kind of the director composer relationship, and everyone always, you know, John Williams and Steven Spielberg, you know, how it evolves over several decades, but this is only your second film, right?
Second film, yeah.
So, but since you had worked with him before, was there any kind of shorthand at this point, or did it feel like you knew Steve, like, kind of better than the first time, or was it different at all?
Well, it's a good question. Well, it's challenging because this film was very different than the first film we did.
Yeah.
The first film we did was also kind of a coming of age, but it was more of a drama. So sensibilities were going to be different, and approach, and, you know, that was also, I want to say, maybe 5 years ago, so it's been some time in between. I think one thing that was beneficial was, obviously, having gone through it with Steve before, I had a little more confidence that he trusted me, and it wasn't like a first-time job, like, don't lose this job, you know, get through it, make sure it's great. So we had a little bit of that helping us in our conversation. You know, at the end of the day, it was still a new film, and it was a new tone, so it was challenging getting there. But, you know, I think just the thing that helped was just having gone through it before and feeling, you know, comfortable with his presence and our shorthand of communication. Right. That's like really key to new relationships, is developing the shorthand and being able to translate what, when they're telling me something, maybe positive, negative, whatever, that I'm able to translate that, and that it comes with, you know, practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it, when you're working with a director, what kind of, I guess from a composer's point of view, what kind of direction do you like? I mean, and as we've, you know, your opinion, I guess, but do you like directors who give a lot of notes and a lot of, you know, like opinions of their point of view and everything? Or do you like a little bit hands off, a little bit more freedom? I mean, what's the, or is there a good balance between both? I mean, I'm sure you've had super controlling micromanaging directors and producers, and you've probably had people who are like, I don't care, whatever you want to do. But so where's the balance that you like?
Are any of my directors going to be seeing this?
I don't know. you don't have, no names.
You know, I mean, the more information, the better. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think with any part of creating and collaborating, you know, trust between the two of you is the ideal place to get to. It doesn't always, it's not always a realistic thing or goal.
Right.
But, you know, when there's, when you're able to, and it works on both ways, you know, when the director or producer or showrunner comes to you with an idea, and you go to them with an idea, and you know, if you both can hear each other, and let's say, or you're open to hearing each other, and can take that and turn it into something that you both really believe in and fall in love with and get behind, then for me that's the ultimate goal. I know. You know, notes, you're going to get notes. Everybody's going to get notes. Yep. I'm going to get notes. The editor's going to get notes. The everyone all down post gets notes. It's just part of the business. You know, again, it's part of collaborating. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, if there's a way to talk and through things and, you know, you can always kind of come to a common denominator and get to the ultimate goal that you're trying to get to in a way without getting, you know, confrontational or uncomfortable or anything like that.
Do you ever feel comfortable saying, actually, I think you're wrong, and I think this is the correct way to do it?
I mean, it's never, well, I think that is only...
Not with that verbiage, but saying, hey, maybe you should try this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, politicians or, you know, it's if you can have a way of politically or, you know, just, you know, being like a bit of a, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? I have a friend who's a producer on a show, and they call her the Velvet Hammer because she has a way of... being the nice guy and the tough guy and all the same. I think there's a way of just communicating something, and if you really believe in it and you really feel strongly that you want to make that call or that opinion or that suggestion, mm-hmm. by all means. I mean, if you have a good trust going back and forth, you can always say it. They can always hear you. They can always say, you know what, that might be a good idea. Or I think I want to try it this way first. Let's see how it goes. Because that happens a lot too. Like, you know, it's always a guessing game. You're not quite sure what you're going to get into. Like, okay, we talk. We can talk till we're, you know, dry and, you know, run out, lose our voice. But until you sit down and start doing something, it's hard to predict.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's collaborative. So it's all about kind of getting comfortable with working with other people.
And speaking of collaboration, you've done a lot of collaboration with other composers and co-composing, of course, with Brian Tyler, Ed Rogers, John Debney. How does the dynamic change when you're working with another composer? What are the benefits of having two minds working on something and kind of complementing each other?
Well, you, I mean, it's great. You get to share ideas, you get to share inspiration, you get to learn. I think it's fantastic, and you know, I think it also varies depending on like where you are as yourself as a composer. You know, so by meaning, when I when I met John and Brian, you know, I was a younger composer and still kind of learning my craft, and still, and I, you know, looked to both of them as you know, mentors in a way, was learning a lot from them, and at the same time building my confidence and you know, being opinionated and trying things and trying to impress not only, you know, the filmmakers, but them, really.
Yeah.
And be like, you know, it became like a musical collaboration. It was
Was that a great place to also to fail, to learn from mistakes, like having
absolutely
yeah
because you know, I would, if I send something over, and you know, because we all, when you do a collaboration, when you co-compose, at least in my experience, mm-hmm. you're always listening to each other's work, or even as an arranger, I did a lot of arranging, or they would hear my work, and you know, it would always get talked about and or revised, polished before it goes to production for preview. So any times I would get notes back, and this in it, all across the board, composition, producing, programming, the list of educational, you know, the bucket was deep. It was great, and it was perfect for me and for, you know, who I was as a composer at the time and where I was headed and where I wanted to go, and you know, almost like a second education at times.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I enjoy it. I still enjoy it. If the, you know, the right things come up and we can put it on the schedule, I would love to do it again.
I think what you and Ed did for Bloodline, I thought was really cool. I thought that was a great show and a great score.
You guys so much fun. Yeah. And you know, that to that point, you know, Ed, on another side of things, Ed and I met at the SC program, and that was like, you know, working with my best friend. It was, it was a lot of fun. It was a different kind of pressure for the two of us, but also fun, because I kind of felt more in the same boat, you know, with John and Brian. It was like, you know, the bright light guys, but you know, it was just a different kind of thing. But such a good time.
Absolutely. So you do have another movie coming up, Wishman. Which is and when is it released at for that?
I don't know. So we just finished the score.
Right.
Film's called Wishman, directed by Theo Davies, and it's a biography film. It's about a co-founder of the Make a Wish Foundation.
Right. Right.
And his backstory, and just finished. We just mixed that in August. So it's an indie film. So right now it's going through the sales, trying to find
a distributor. Yeah.
So. To be determined, and but it's coming out. I'm really, really excited for that one.
I mean, talk about scoring a film. Of course, it's not a documentary. It's a biography, biopic. But when you're dealing with real people in real lives, does it change the approach at all when you know that, you know, people who know these people and they're themselves could be watching, and you know, just like, does it change how you do your job?
Yeah, I mean, well, I know it's funny because
there's more pressure.
I knew that he was getting, well, similar to like Scorpion, you know, the Walter O'Brien. It's funny tie there. So the producer on Wishman, when I first got on and started working with the job, says, "Oh, you know, I'm good friends with Walter O'Brien from Scorpion." I was like, "Really?" I was like, "Oh my God, that's wild." So, yes, his real life, and then the movie that we're working on is about the real life. Person, and yeah, I mean, I know he's going to be seeing it. I know they're going to be playing music for him, and he's, you know, he's not necessarily involved in the creative, but because it's about him, obviously he's going to be around.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I felt a little bit of pressure there, but as you know, at the end of the day, you know, I settle in, and it's just me and the director and the story, and you know, slight pressure, but it doesn't petrify me or
you
know, anything like that.
So kind of going back to some big picture kind of discussion, just your general approach. When you're, I was talking with Ryan Tyler recently about confidence, and you mentioned confidence earlier. Where do you find, I guess, the confidence that you need for this job? Because you do need a certain amount of confidence to be able to talk to somebody, and you know, you need to believe in your ideas and get behind your ideas. Did that come naturally at the beginning, or did you have to kind of work your way into how you present yourself professionally with all these other kind of collaborating storytellers?
Yeah, great question. I think confidence for everybody is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, you know, without sounding too confident.
Exactly, but you don't want to sound too pompous.
You know, I think for me, I needed to do a lot of writing for a long time before I felt confident in continuing to write.
Right.
And that means a lot of writing, music that people rejected, a lot of music that people loved, and just, you know, all over the spectrum of it. It's like a muscle, and it builds with, you know, time and repetition and getting comfortable and learning who you are. You know, one of the things when I came in as a young composer was I didn't really think too far out, like, who am I? Because I came from a really traditional composer, film composer world, meaning I studied music of film composers. And I had this rock and roll background from, like, my youth, but really I was studying, you know, Thomas Newman and Danny Elfman and Bernard Herrmann and what these guys were doing. And it took a while for me to get to a place to absorb that and let it go and decide, okay, I'm not going to be Bernard Herrmann. This is not going to happen. They're not looking for Bernard Herrmann scores right now. And what am I going to do with that? So it took a lot of time to decide, okay, what am I good at? What am I decent at? And how can I expand upon that? And what do I want to do that may be different than that and grow that way?
And you're finding your voice, essentially.
Finding your voice. Yeah. Yes.
Because if you want to be Hans Zimmer, it's not going to end well because there's already a Hans Zimmer.
There's already a Hans
Zimmer. So you got to be yourself and find what you have to offer,
I guess. It's really hard that's a hard thing to look in the mirror and do, really, you know, at the end of the day. There's so many wonderful composers. And there's so many, you know, there are opportunities, but, you know, there's a lot of people that people can choose from. I think, you know, just being confident in yourself, continuing to practice, being a collaborator, and, you know, a good attitude goes a long way too. You know, I know people certainly appreciate a calm, you know, presence, or, you know, if they want to be in the room with you and just hang out with you, you know, that will do a lot.
Yeah.
Because then you can go through those tough conversations of, like, okay, I got to talk to you about your confidence in your writing. but, you know, seriously, it just takes, you know, and I think maturity comes into it, I think, you know, and everybody has a different sliding scale.
Sure.
but yeah, it's true.
And when you deal with rejection, I mean, which can take a blow to your confidence, because this industry is nothing but rejection, whether you're getting fired off a project, which is, you know, get replaced, or a piece gets rejected. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? I mean, is it, of course you can't take it personally, but did you ever take it personally at the beginning?
No. Talking
I'll take a sip too. I'll let you get me hanging.
Step one, rejection.
Rejection.
There's the rejection.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Drink the pain away, step one.
So, Petey, okay. So, you know, I don't know. For me personally, you know, I think trying to understand why you either got rejected or lost a job or didn't get hired for a job you really wanted to get onto, you know, some things are out of your control. Most things are out of your control. If you know, having a moment with it, okay, that sucks. That doesn't feel good. And then moving on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's nothing positive about hanging on to, you know,
it's not gonna bad feelings.
It's not going to do you any good. You're not going to go, you know, there's nothing to do about it, really. When it's moved on, it's moved on. You can't call back and say, hey, let's just, you know, one more time, please.
Just listen to it. You'll love it.
I promise if I turn up that one part, no, it doesn't work like that. So, you know, it's part of the game. It never gets easy.
Yeah.
It always hurts. It always feels personal. But usually it's never personal.
Right.
It's always about a creative business and you know,
like I said, it's for the film. It's for whatever the picture is.
For the film. Yeah. If you get a cue that gets, you know, and it goes all, you know, big things like, you know, losing a job or not getting hired, down to getting cues thrown back on you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just turn around and you know, you lick your wounds and you get back up and keep going.
Yeah. So to wrap up, looking at the industry today, and you've grown into the industry for you know, many years, what are some good things that you're seeing right now in 2018? What are some bad things, maybe things that could be improved upon in terms of the music industry or maybe entertainment industry in general?
Let's start with great, you know, positive stuff. I think, you know, the good things, I feel like there's so much going on, right? And there's so much really great content out there.
Yeah.
There's, that's exciting. I can't even keep up with all the great content as far as a viewer goes, you know, which is an exciting thing because you, like, always know if you get a lull in life and you're just sitting around and you don't have kids and, you know, so that's exciting to me. I love, you know, discovering and learning new names and new composers that have been out there. You know, as you know, I've been in town what feels like a really long time. So I see, you know, I'm definitely in touch, and I, you know, I watch, and I'm a fan of, you know, a lot of, you know, new work that I end up discovering, or composers I never heard of, but I see a product, I'm like, wow, what's that? It's fantastic. So that's inspiring. It keeps you going. You know, it's kind of part of staying fresh. And I feel like, you know, really blessed and fortunate to be around, you know, what feels like a really, you know, important time for film and TV music,
yeah.
And maybe an evolution of it. It's exciting. And to be here and to be working, it's just, it's an honor. It's crazy. Yeah. I don't know about, you know, negative. I mean, who wants to be negative? I don't know. Say bad things about people. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, sometimes, you know, all I can think of is, you know, if I had to wish, I would just wish maybe there was a little more time to do
more time,
you know,
post
stuff. But I mean, I don't know. That's like a never ending, you know, all composers will say the same thing. Yeah.
No, for sure. Well, Tony, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's of course always a pleasure to chat. And
Thanks for having me.
I mean, congrats on all the amazing work. It's always a pleasure to hear you grow, and I've always been listening to you since you started. And so it's a great pleasure to pick your brain.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.